supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Rohingya Muslims are considered the most persecuted ethnic minority in the world. Deadly crackdowns in Myanmar, where most live, have created a refugee crisis that's driven thousands of Rohingya Muslims out of the Southeast Asian country. A few dozen have made their way to Philadelphia. WHYY's Dana DiFilippo talked with two Rohingya sisters about what they left behind and how they're doing now.
Before they came to Philadelphia, Farida Rashid and her younger sister Noor lived in Malaysia, where Rohingya Muslims are treated slightly better than in Myanmar. Still, the Malaysian government doesn't recognize the Rohingya as citizens, so they can't go to public schools, work, get affordable health care, or even walk around freely. Farida says her family had no future there.
I born there. I grew up over there, even though I have birth certificate. They don't recognize me as their people. I can't do any business. You can't even have a driving lesson. They don't recognize you at all. Basically, we do nothing.
So 5 years after they first applied for refugee status, they were approved and moved to the United States last year with the help of the Philly-based resettlement agency, the Nationality Services Center.
From Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, we went to Hong Kong. And from Hong Kong, we took flight, came down to the United States, all together 22 hours. And that was our first flight. In our entire life, we've not been in a plane at all.
The sisters, who are 25 and 22, often fall into giggles as they talk about their life here, like wonderstruck kids in an amusement park. That's because life is so different for them here, so much better. Every day is an exciting adventure, always holding lessons to learn, like American holidays. Farida laughs as she remembers trying to figure out what the heck Halloween was.
The Halloween. I get two different answers from my friend. If I did ask one of my friends, how's your Halloween preparation? No, I don't celebrate Halloween. I say, why? Oh no, it's like devil's birthday. We are not celebrating devil's birthday. Okay, I asked the other friend. Oh, she has been busy shopping, costume for her kids, candies. I said two different answers. I get it from here. So I found out one is worshipping devils and the other one is not worshipping devils.
The sisters learn to speak English in Malaysia, but American slang, that can be a mystery. Take the day Noor's co-workers at Walmart asked if she'd gotten a customer's phone number.
They was teasing me the other day, did you take the digit? So I was like thinking, what was the digit they mean? But actually they was like, did you take the number of the person? So I was like, what? It was so confusing.
But don't think they're complaining. Noor says a little confusion about the holidays and slang is a small price to pay for the freedom that they found in Philadelphia. The sisters have jobs. They're both going to school. Farida wants to be a teacher someday, while Noor is studying nursing.
We can have a bright future over here. We can be what we want, and also we can support our family as well as our community.
They have applied for green cards. If they get them, after waiting 5 more years, they can apply for citizenship. Their ultimate goal is to bring their relatives from Malaysia here, too. That could take years, but by then they'll surely be experts on American holidays and slang. Dana DiFilippo.
The Philadelphia Eagles won their game against the Los Angeles Rams yesterday, but they lost something much bigger. Carson Wentz, the team's star quarterback, tore his left ACL and will miss the rest of the season that seemed to have Super Bowl potential. Now the spotlight turns to Wentz's backup, a familiar face in the Philadelphia region, as WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports.
Back in 2013, Kevin Lancaster bought his first Eagles jersey.
It was probably my most unwise investment I ever made.
Unwise because the name on the back was Nick Foles. Back then, Foles looked like a rising star quarterback for the playoff-bound Birds. But the Eagles traded him a year later, and he soon became a journeyman.
Yep, it was the first jersey I bought, and I've been too embarrassed to make a similar mistake again.
Now the Eagles have a new rising star, Carson Wentz. and the best record in the NFL. Naturally, Lancaster was glued to the TV on Sunday.
I was watching the game wearing my dumb Foles jersey when it happened.
Well, nobody wants to see this. Carson Wentz is going off to get looked at.
Yep, my pajama pants and my Nick Foles jersey.
It turned out to be a prophetic clothing choice. The Eagles' backup quarterback is Nick Foles, who the team re-signed this year as an insurance policy. Now the former savior has to salvage this once promising season. But can he?
It's hard to see us getting all the way to the Super Bowl without Wentz, but man, I'd love to see it happen. I'm sure Nick Foles would too.
Most fans, like Lancaster, are skeptical of Foles' ability. But at the very least, his jersey is in vogue, proving once again that fashion and quarterbacks are cyclical. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Residents of Eastwick, a neighborhood partly built over wetlands near Philadelphia Airport, are about to complete a plan for what to do with public land there. The planning process has not been easy. Catalina Jaramillo of WHYY's Plan Philly reports on how past betrayals by city officials are fueling resistance and a conspiracy theory.
Eastwick is located in the lowest lying area of Philadelphia. It's surrounded by creeks, rivers, and wetlands. So when a storm comes, water flows into the neighborhood from all directions. More than 100 properties have flooded 10 times or more in the past 20 years. Climate change projections and sea level rise are making the problem worse. But members of Eastwick United, a 30-year-old neighborhood organization, do not believe the flooding problems are natural.
We need to dispel the fact that this is a flood area.
That's Darian Thomas, a pastor and member of Eastwick United. This year, Eastwick has been going through a planning process. There are 200 acres of land owned by the city at stake. The city invited residents to discuss what should be done with that land, considering the flooding situation. But Eastwick United members say the city shouldn't make decisions based on flooding. The only time the whole neighborhood flooded, they say, was with Hurricane Floyd in 1999. Here's Leo Brundage, a longtime Eastwick resident.
Hurricane Floyd was not one of them floods that you get every 33 years.
Many residents believe Eastwick flooded then because water was intentionally released from the Springtongue Lake Dam, a 3.5 billion gallon reservoir in Delaware County. They believe officials wanted to protect media, a wealthier and wider suburb.
We got flooded from Hurricane Floyd because of the dam. We all know that. You know, you ask anybody that's been around here, that was here during Floyd, they will tell you.
But official accounts contradict that belief. While there were warnings of a hole in the dam during Floyd, it held and never burst. Chris Crockett, chief environmental officer with Aqua America, which operates the dam, says the dam drains into the Cram Creek. Eastwick is in the Darby Creek watershed. And even though both creeks drain into the Delaware River, Crockett says the water that did go through the dam spillway during Floyd is not enough to have any effect in Eastwick.
When you look at the volume of water the Delaware River was moving during Hurricane Floyd, which was hundreds of thousands of cubic feet per second, and you look at the flow gauge at Crum Creek, it literally was a drop in the bucket.
Other experts working on Eastwick environmental study agree. If the water was released during the storm, it would have flooded the downstream areas of Cram Creek, not Eastwick. But none of this changes Brundage's mind.
Listen, they can't tell me. They can give you an academic view. Yeah, fine. Probably the best around. But I'm giving you factual. I know exactly what happened. Our experience would happen.
Brundage and his neighbors have reasons to distrust city officials. In 1950, the city declared Eastwick blighted and used eminent domain to seize more than 2,000 acres for an urban renewal project. More than 8,000 residents were displaced. Eastwick was designated blighted in part because of its flooding problems. Yet, the new development only made the problem worse. Resettled and new Eastwick residents moved to a neighborhood with sinking homes, toxic landfills, and more flood risks. Now, the neighborhood is going through a new plan. Planners say that some areas in Eastwick could be developed, but others would have to be used to mitigate flooding. Eastwick United members fear officials are using the flooding argument again to deny them the kind of development the community needs. Schools, community centers, and businesses. So the city can give the land to someone with bigger pockets. Here's Pastor Thomas again.
Because of the lie that we live in a flooded area, it has kept people back from developing our community, thinking that, we can't develop that area because that's a swamp. Well, they didn't say that to the developers who came here years ago and wiped everybody out, and they built.
Greg Heller is Philadelphia's Redevelopment Authority's executive director. He says he understands the distrust in Eastwick.
We're talking about decades of history. You're not going to change that overnight. But I do think this process has been a big step forward.
Heller says overcoming the neighborhood's deep suspicion will be hard, but he's committed to doing the responsible thing. City officials and Eastwick residents only have a couple of months left to make compromises. And judging from the last meeting, where residents disagreed fiercely with one another, there's still a long way to go. Catalina Jaramillo, WHYY News.
With clear night skies, the Geminid meteor shower comes into view this week. Let's look aloft with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, what part of the sky are we looking in and which days are featured?
It's this Wednesday and Thursday evenings that we're going to look over to the northeastern portion of the sky where the constellation Gemini, which is better known as a springtime constellation, late at night will be making its debut. But accompanying the constellation itself will be the meteors that you spoke of, the Geminid meteors. Now, the Geminids are actually members of the most prominent meteor shower of the year. And not too long ago, a decade or so, it was the Perseid meteor shower that was the prominent shower. This is the one that everybody knows that happens every summer in August. And of course, it's a great time to go out and view these objects as they zoom into our atmosphere. The challenge, of course, with the Geminids is that it happens in mid-December, when it's much more likely for the temperature to be cold and maybe not as inviting to be out. But in the winter, of course, the skies can be much clearer, so that might give us a better view of these objects as they come zipping into the atmosphere.
What time in the night sky? As soon as it gets dark?
You know, the best way to view meteors always is to do your viewing between midnight and sunrise as the Earth is rotating into the stream of meteors as we're heading towards sunrise. However, maybe you're not able to be up between midnight and sunrise for whatever reason. So I always say, just go out as soon as the sky gets dark and hang out for as long as you can.
What's the flow rate of this stream?
Well, this one is pretty intense. It's around 100 per hour, easily viewable. The Perseid meteor shower only peaks around 60, 65 an hour, which in itself is a lot. But 100 per hour, well, that's pretty good. So hopefully, clear dark skies, and you have some friends with you, you might be able to count a significant number.
You said just recently the Perseid was the predominant shower. Did this come as a surprise with Geminid now ascendant?
Well, the interesting thing about this is that we know that the dynamics of meteor showers changes over time, simply because there's a denser portion of the stream along the orbit of the object that creates the original material.
And while you're already out of doors, what other treats are there to be seen in the December night sky?
You know, while the evening sky may not be so exciting to see because there aren't any bright planets left, on Wednesday morning, the 13th, Mars will be not too far from the moon. In fact, just a little bit to the right and just a little below the moon, nice reddish color. And then Jupiter the next morning, Thursday morning, you'll be able to recognize that immediately because it's the brighter of the planets, and it's the same position again. And this is around 5:30 to 6:30 in the morning. And if the sky is clear, it'll be beautiful because the moon is at a very, very thin crescent. It's 2 days away from new, so it's about the thinnest of a crescent you can imagine. That always makes a beautiful panoply of planets and the moon seen together in the pre-dawn sky.
Lastly, looking out to Sunday, that date summons anniversary memories of the work of one Orville Wright.
It was 114 years ago on December 17, 1903, that Orville Wright took the first powered flight. It was a biplane, very alien to what we think of these days as aircraft. But the thing that's most remarkable to me about that is that Not too much later, 69 years later, the Apollo 17 spacecraft landed on the moon with the last crew of astronauts to visit the moon. It was Harrison Schmitt and Gene Cernan who walked around on the moon for a couple of days collecting rocks, setting experiments, and bringing back materials to us. And just to think, in that short period of time, 69 years, from powered flight all the way out to taking people to the moon, was a remarkable period of time for people to live across. And we still think about the achievements when we look up at the moon, even if it's that very thin crescent we see in the pre-dawn sky, and imagine what it must have been like for those gentlemen to leave the moon just 3 days later on that Thursday of that week.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. The Art of Swimming is a play about Mercedes Glitzel, the first British woman to swim the English Channel, and the challenges she faced to be recognized for her achievement in a time when female athletes were a rarity. Written by Scotland-based playwright Linda Radley, it's currently being staged in Philadelphia by Tiny Dynamite. Just like Glitzel's solo feat, actress Lee Minora is also solo on stage, taking the audience inside the thoughts that fill the swimmer's head as the hours and endless strokes go by. Accompanied by cellist Daniel Eisen, Minora stopped by WHYY to perform a sample.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to my performance. In order for it to work, I will need you to sometimes imagine that I am Mercedes Glitzel, the first British woman to swim the English Channel. This I did in 1927, aged 26, and it took 15 hours and 15 minutes. If it helps you to have a more fulfilling theatrical experience, you can imagine that I did decide to spend the exorbitant amount of money they were asking for in the secondhand clothing shop where I found an authentic period swimming costume. You know, one of those that comes down to here and looks like something a wrestler might wear. It was navy blue and made out of cotton jersey. I am taller than I am, obviously, and broader, with a long mane of dark hair. I am famed for my beauty as well as my talent. I say, in the open sea, you've no idea what's coming next. You must make your peace with currents and tides. You must learn how to track them. You have to swim straight, but you cannot waste too much energy on looking up. So you learn blind how to navigate a straight, liquid line. You must learn how to swim in the dark. You can only think minuscule thoughts. Stroke. Pull. Stroke. Pull. Stroke. Pull. Don't think, and there's nothing to distract you from the cold. Think too much, and your mind will find a way to convince you to stop. So you focus on direction, navigation, drinking, urinating, pacing, hours, minutes, and seconds. Your inner engineer must travel internally, monitoring each temperature change, feeling each fluctuation, assessing the quality of each breath. Each stroke, pull. Stroke, pull. Stroke, pull. You speak to your lungs and you say, you are bigger than this. You speak to your heart and you say, don't beat faster, slow down. You speak to your spine and you say, keep rotating. You speak to your legs and you say, keep kicking. You speak to your arms and you say, keep pulling. You speak to your joints and you say, look, you can have your revenge when I'm old. Each time your mind wanders toward the pain, you must pick it up and pluck it away from the brink like a wayward child. Every time an image of failure comes to you, you must cast it back into the blue. If you feel the swell of early celebration, you had better check yourself, because your strokes will have turned sloppy and you're breathing too fast. You just have to be. Letting your conscious mind take care of the machine and your subconscious float to the surface like a cork. You just have to swim.
Actress Lee Minora and cellist Daniel Eisen performing a scene from The Art of Swimming. It's being staged by Tiny Dynamite through the weekend. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. A local police officer who went on to become an FBI profiler and ultimately cracked the Unabomber case has risen to celebrity status thanks to a miniseries telling his story. We'll hear from the real Special Agent James Fitzgerald on tomorrow's show. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.